Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell. And still in the studio after a whole week, Louise Etchegoyen from the Chemistry Department and Bruce Cushing from the Department of Biological Sciences. And we're going to continue our discussion on what was interesting last year, what's going to be the future, and, you know, a little discussion about the role of science in modern society, or the role of modern society in science, actually. So, Bruce, let's go back to you now. What's another area that you are particularly entertained by?
So one of the things I found fascinating is the use of anesthetics and previously what would have been thought of psychedelic recreational drugs now to try and treat mental health issues, especially things like depression and PTSD, which are very common, unfortunately. And one of them that's become the more recognized use, we just had the federal government allow certify a ketamine nasal spray. So ketamine was originally, I read different things. I thought it was a cat anesthetic. I used to use it to tranquilize polar bears with. That was an interesting thing. So
it's
ketamine,
a brave thing to do, to try to anesthetize a polar bear. But carry on.
Well, I'm still here, so apparently it worked. And I met my wife, too. Nancy, I have to throw her in. That'll get me in good stead. So ketamine has been studied for quite a while in mice and other things. It's a very interesting drug because it's been described sort of if you take it at a recreational level, which no one should do. This stuff is really horrible. That it's been described to me as sort of sitting on top of a locker and looking at yourself down on a bench. So it's sort of that otherworldly removed drug. You also have heard people maybe, if you know about this drug, talking about going down a rabbit hole, and it causes psychosis in people. It was used as a drug, as an anesthetic, and caused real, sometimes serious problems as people came in or went out.
And long-term?
A month later,
it's all gone away.
Yeah, pretty much. So it causes people to use it recreationally has caused some very serious issues with them. But at a lower dose, they found that it has a real ability to have immediate effects. One of the areas is in people who are suicidal. Literally one dose at times can take them out of that suicidal state of depression. It can bring back an ability to laugh and enjoy life at a lower dose.
Yeah, but I mean, that was serendipity. It could have increased their suicidal tendency.
It was, but there have been a lot of work done in mice and other things to show that it has an antidepressant effect at low levels. So ketamine is now, there are ketamine clinics all over the United States where you can go get it intravenously. They use it for pain. That's another thing that I find fascinating is that we haven't studied this, and this is me going off on a branch a little bit, but there seems to be a real relationship between pain and PTSD and depression. So ketamine seems to have an effective relief in depression and PTSD for some people, not everyone. But it's also used to treat pain. And now we're starting to use LSD is starting to be used and what we used to refer to as magic mushrooms. I'm sure neither one of you ever had anything to do with any of that stuff. But those are now starting to be used also for treatment. I think Anderson Cooper just recently did a show where he went, and I made a mistake, so you may have to cut this out, but did like LSD, a low dose. So these are done under very controlled clinical conditions at lower doses.
I know you use voles as a sort of a substitute for people, and mice are always being used, and rats, etc. Suicidal tendencies and things like that, depression. How do you see this in animal studies?
Suicidal is hard to do. Depression is not so hard to do. We use the same things. Voles actually respond pretty much just like human beings. If you have a depressed vole, you see the same change in cardiac responses. You see what they do in rats and voles and other things is you see, like, they give them sugar water, and they don't want it. They have a reduction in their pleasure levels. They have a reduction in social interactions. So you see very similar events, especially in voles, which is why they're such a great model.
I didn't know that the cardiac response was associated, that you could track depression by studying cardiac response.
Yes, yes.
What happens?
Well, you get change in arrhythmias. You get changes in the level at which the heart responds to different things. So I'm on a publication with this, but I'm not an expert on it. But, yeah, you can track long-term depression through
changes. That's science for you. We've got papers on it, but we're not experts.
We do. So you can track it. So these are model systems where you can then treat them with these drugs, and you can see that they then start enjoying and show pleasure levels.
So this has been established for some time. Last year was very intense, and this is what you're thinking into the future.
Well, last year was really the breakthrough for ketamine because it became recognized by insurance companies. And literally, that's one of our big breakthroughs, right? When insurance companies start paying for things, and they developed a nasal spray, but that still has to be delivered at a clinic. The use of LSD and psychedelic mushrooms, I think, is several years back where ketamine was and may get there, but you're not seeing the opening of clinics at this point.
Do you want to jump into this conversation? Nothing to do with magic mushrooms or whatever.
No.
Okay. Your point was to talk about dosing and stuff, and right. just yesterday or the day before, I saw on the BBC website this new breakthrough treatment for different types of tuberculosis using a vaccine that I took, you know, as a 10-year-old because my stepmother had TB at home. And now they're saying this is great for some of the more resistant forms. Not the drug has not changed, the vaccine hasn't changed, but how you give it. It's going to be given intravenously. It's also going to be given over shorter doses. This seems to me to be a very big new area. And in fact, a metronomic drug delivery or something like this. I mean, it's all part of a new approach to therapy?
Well, I think in general we're finding a lot of things that we always thought more was better. We've always thought a lot of things respond on a logarithmic scale, and what we know is that we're exponential, and we know that that's really not true a lot of the times. And there is a lot of that, and yeah.
Okay, so then that's your prediction into the future. It sounds quite vivid. Luis, what's your other or another area of progress?
Okay, yeah. So let's get back to chemistry here a little bit, or more materials science, I would say. My next selection are the two-dimensional materials, which is really kind of amazing that by just simply going from a three-dimensional structure, meaning, for example, graphite, and this was the first example that really revolutionized, and these physicists, Geim and Novoselov, got the Nobel Prize literally a year or 2 years right after they did the experiment, which is if you take graphite, which are just layers of monolayers of single carbon hexagonal structures piled up on top of each other, by just selecting one of those, and one of those layers is called graphene, the properties are completely different from the properties of the graphite.
Let me just point out to the listener that graphite, you can find it if you go down to the railway stations. You know, they always put a bit of graphite. It looks just like a pencil lead, you know, in there because it's a wonderful lubricant because the layers shuffle off.
That's great.
One after the other. And you're saying about the individual layer here called graphene.
Yeah, and it's interesting because these fellows got the Nobel Prize doing this with scotch tape, which is really amazing to me intellectually. You don't need big instruments. You don't need expensive anything. You just need a little bit of scotch tape and pencil, the lead on a pencil, and just start removing layer by layer until you end up with one layer.
So what are some of the properties of this?
The properties of these things are absolutely amazing. The graphene, which is just carbon, is another allotropic form or pure carbon form, has the best conductance of any material, much better than copper by a thousandfold and things like that. So they have unique properties just to a single layer. But the beauty of the properties, and by the way, 3 weeks ago, the first commercial product that I am aware of using graphene came out on the market, and it is in earbuds. So you can actually use earphones where the membrane that transduces the electricity and sound responds much better in the high and low frequency regime. So you need to buy yourself earplugs now that have graphene in them, right? Because technology has advanced. So that's one. But many more are coming in optoelectronics, which means photovoltaics or solar cells using graphene as well. But it opened up. People started saying, if we take one layer of graphite and it's so different from graphite, how about taking one layer of other things? And it has opened up a whole new field where you have metallic sulfides like molybdenum sulfide, tungsten sulfide, and all of them have different properties where you can tune the band gap. The band gap is the energy necessary to excite electrons in it. That is important for photovoltaics and other optoelectronics.
And so this has also had a great impact on Scotch tape, or have they got different methodologies nowadays?
They do different methodologies. it continues to be a problem because growing them as such as single layers is not easy. You do chemical vapor deposition, which is expensive and not super dependable. It's very difficult to work with. So people have used solvent exfoliation or separating these things in N-methyl pyrrolidone and things like that.
Go to what you see, some of the potential. Okay, so good for earplugs because of conductivity.
Solar cells.
Solar cell is the big one.
Solar cells for sure. Composite materials, so they are so strong. These things are incredibly strong, just like the carbon nanotubes are, that they are fantastic, much better than fiber. Carbon fibers in rackets, tennis rackets.
I was going to say, so is it as dependable as, say, carbon fibers have become?
Yes.
So you think that graphene as a material will be replacing the nanotubes, for example?
For sure.
In tennis rackets?
For sure. It's so strong. It's super strong, just like the nanotubes are, and they conduct thermally and electricity as well, so electrons and...
Let me sort of switch over and ask Bruce then, if again, this type of two-dimensional material, I can imagine that clothing is now being made out of materials, so that your body exudes a certain material, you've got a sensor there, and then you can be said, this man needs more food, less food, whatever, or this lady. Do you see some utility here?
But I have to be careful. And Luis, I would pose a slightly different question to you. Nanotubes, carbon tubes, carbon fibers are also horrific pollutants.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that if there's anything that's really going to kill us, those things are highly likely to, because lungs and tissue and cells can't respond to that, are things like graphene and black phosphorus, are they safer, or do they pose the same risk? I'm sorry, Keith, I know that's
not the question,
but as a biologist, that's an area where chemistry actually scares the daylights out of me, because our system is not capable of clearing those things out.
Yeah, and I don't know the biological studies that have been done. I think of all of these that you have mentioned, the nanotubes might be the only ones that, because of the aspect ratio, they're long, just like asbestos fibers, and people have likened them to asbestos fibers. They could potentially have some deleterious effects.
Well, I mean,
I don't know.
That's established from work all over now, that nanomaterials, these little nanoparticles,
right,
is what you're really talking about.
Right.
Go everywhere, all right? And it's not at all clear that we should be developing technology at this stage. But it's out there because business is quicker to respond to science and technology than we are.
But people working in these fields are aware, just like Bruce is and you are, that these are potential problems. And they have conditions under which you can work where things are very, very controlled. And you can really filter out nanoparticles very easily. You can work with these materials in a safe manner, and it really can be controlled. And I don't think it has that much of a potential hazard for humanity.
Okay, and so that's Louis Setchegard, and you heard it here on Science
Studio. I'll be good, but I also would tell you that I don't necessarily agree.
We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to discuss a bigger issue, and that is science as a profession, science as an idea of how do we investigate ourselves on this planet, in this universe. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Louise Etchegoyen, Bruce Cushing. And we've had a really quite delightful discussion, actually. It would have been better in a bar with some, you know, nice wine, and we can do that again. We've done the Science Studio from here with wine once to do a wine tasting. I don't remember the results, but never mind. Okay, so what do we want to do to sort of round out this program or these programs? I'm concerned about the respect that scientists are getting in the modern age. And I'd like to sort of throw this open to either of you to jump in. I know Luis has got some ideas, so I think I'll start with Bruce, all right, just to sort of get your take on this. Where do you think science is in modern America, and is it in a position that you find appropriate and comfortable with?
So no, it's not in a position I find appropriate or comfortable. I didn't think I'd spend my older age feeling like somehow I'm a bad guy. And I don't mean that I'm a bad guy, but we live in a country, unfortunately, I feel, where we are somewhat anti-intellectual. And scientists are somehow, we're out for our grants and we're going to get more dollars that way and we conspire and come up with the groups. When the three of us in this room couldn't probably agree on, you know, if we had 20 things to talk about, we'd be lucky we agree on a half, half a percent. So I find that very disturbing because, in general, most of us, I've spent a long time in this field, most scientists are people who love what they do. I think we're not involved enough. I think we are responsible to some extent for the view that people have of us in that we have not spoken up. We have not thanked federal agencies and our representatives and other people when they do fund us and provide us support for that. We've not spoken up because we live in what we do and we love what we do. We don't necessarily look at the ethics and the impact and how other people view it. That said, I don't think we're the people who generated that view. I think there is a strong anti-intellectualism, and I think it goes back to even your comment about particles and businesses, and it runs ahead. And when we do speak up, we're often not in support of some of those things because they have potential serious impacts. So they don't want to hear what we have to say. So I don't know how we deal with it. I find it very disturbing, and I didn't worry so much about it when I was younger, and it may not have been any different. And fortunately, although maybe Europe is backpedaling, not all of the world is the same as the United States in the view of science.
Yeah, okay, so let me ask Luis the same question. Are you comfortable with where science is in modern America?
Oh, the answer, I think, is obviously no. We have not evolved over the last, 30 years or so the right way. It is very difficult for me to try to understand why the Asian countries are doing collectively so well in terms of scientific progress, in terms of ambition, in terms of really wanting not only the intellectual side of science, but actually the commercialization. They seem to be at the frontier. And if you look at the composition of government in Asian countries and compare it to the composition of our country, I know that we have one out of 535 legislators. Is that how many we have? We have one guy who has a PhD in physics, and that's Bill Foster from Illinois. It's incredible to me that our country is run almost exclusively by politicians, by lawyers, by business people, and science, which runs 50-60% of what we do as a human race, is being discussed and decisions are made by these individuals who have absolutely no idea how science works in the first place. It's totally reversed. You know that one of my good friends is Sir Fraser Stoddart, the Nobel laureate in chemistry in 2016, and he travels on a constant basis. And he says the Asian countries are so far ahead of not only the U.S., but even European countries in terms of their love for science, respect for science, desire to really excel. And I don't know why in our evolutionary pathway, the U.S. went this way. And the Asian countries are going that. I don't know how you reverse this.
Let me sort of bring up, though, you know, when you look at the number of issues that have come up, ethical issues, for example, you alluded in last week's program to some of these experiments on gene extraction and introduction, which were totally beyond the pale. I mean, that doesn't happen in North America. We do have... Because we understand some of the things Bruce was saying. Nanomaterials, MOFs, we've got all sorts of good uses, but we don't quite know where the negatives land up. One way I think we are ahead of the game over here compared to Asia is, in fact, the concern for the ethics, the concern for are we going too fast? Not that we know how to stop it, but I do think there are issues there where we are more cognizant of some of these issues than, say, elsewhere.
But that may be one component, Keith, yeah. That, sure, we're more responsible in the ethical conduct of research and so on. I'm not disagreeing with that. But I sincerely hope that that is not the reason why we are falling behind in terms of the intellectual progress. We need to do things right, but I think we don't have representation in our government. Let's go back to the funding scene, right? One of the things that I intend to do as president of the ACS, since this is an organization of 153,000 members, it has some political clout.
And it has people all over the world.
All over the world. 20% of the 153,000 are living in a country outside the U.S. And it has gravitas. It has muscle in Washington. I have all the intention of trying to orchestrate something that is credible to even legislators, people who don't know science but can actually understand that in putting money into science, fundamental science, and the data are there, is not an expense for the country. It's an investment for the country. And putting money in there will give you money in the long run.
I did about 3 weeks ago a science studio with Susan Gordon. She was the principal deputy for national intelligence. Okay. So this is an interesting feature here, Luis, because just about 3 weeks ago, I did a science studio with Susan Gordon, who was the principal deputy at the Intelligence Service of the United States. I don't get the titles properly. But I asked her very simply. She was in charge of CIA and things like that. But I said, look, you know, CIA is out there looking at negative things that are impacting the U.S. Do you ever look at the anti-science aspects of society? And she said, well, she understood that they were there. And her solution was just to simply give far more money for basic research, but somehow the application, move it out of the universities to a certain extent. I mean, she thinks more basic fundamental research is important. And if I've misquoted you, Susan Gordon, you know, I apologize.
May I say something?
Yeah,
there is a study that for me, very fundamental, that was published. Unfortunately, it's a little bit dated. I think it was 2006 or 2005. But in essence, it remains the same today. They showed a bibliographic analysis of money-making patents for the U.S., $60 billion, and traced it all the way back to the papers in the Science and Nature and JAX and so on. So the correlation is there. There's no question about it. You put money into fundamental science, and what comes out the other way is $1 billion investment gives you a $60 billion industry, the chemical industry. I'm talking about chemistry exclusively now. That is still true today. And other countries realize it. The Asian countries realize it very, very well. We have, for some reason, forgotten that if you don't build the base, you cannot have technology. So you cannot invest just on technology. You need someone to do the fundamental discoveries of the layer, graphene, and whatever. Without that, you never actually produce.
You don't worry that a new assistant professor is coming into an academic environment these days in North America, which says, you know, you've got to get intellectual property, you've got to get your patents. And that's driving them in the wrong direction.
So let me jump in here. I think that the answer is yes. That is a serious issue. The problem is that so I agree with the funding. We have a problem with politicians who take pride in saying, I'm not a scientist. Hey, I don't know what, you're not an economist either, but you decide what the economy is going to do. That's a serious issue. And the serious issue is the dollar-driven aspect. We look back in science, and what you can go back and see is that many things that we had no idea of direction or where they would go turn out to be incredibly powerful. We need to keep that aspect because the problem with the patents and the direction is the idea that it must be something that's productive for society. We have no idea where the direction of the future is. That's the beauty of science done at universities, where you have the freedom and you get discoveries that you can go back. NSF's favorite one is green fluorescent protein taken from a jellyfish, right? Then it was stupid. You know, it was one of the golden fleece awards, and it turns out to be something that's really important later on. We don't know where it's going to go. And the other thing that we fail to do as scientists that I'd like to bring up, because your longer term, Luis, is really correct about you can look at investment and return. But the other thing that we don't do as scientists that I think we really need to push, which a friend of mine did, who's currently the VP for research at Texas State, was that we are also a tremendous economic engine right now. When you give a grant, and you give me a grant for $150,000, I employ three people off that. They're working. They're learning, working, and becoming productive. You give $10 million to a road crew and you hire four people. And we do not push what an economic immediate engine research really is.
We've just got 1 minute left. I don't think I want to do a third program, all right? But we might get together with the people who are coming next week from physics and geology and have a fifth session at the end of that where all five of us get around the table and, you know, see if we resolved anything. Bruce Cushing, delight to have you here on Science Studio.
It was really a great pleasure, and thank you for inviting me to be on at St. Thomas, Luis.
It's worth doing. Luis, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for inviting me, Keith. It's been a lot of fun to not only talk to you, but exchange ideas with
absolutely
well.
And it's needed. And Sam Cassiano, thank you in there. I'd like to thank the audience for being out there. Hope you've enjoyed this little 2 weeks of conversations, and if you have, let us know, because we might do this more often. Take care, and we'll be seeing you next week.